From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A child sex abuse scandal has seared the very soul of the Catholic Church. Along with outrage, there is anguish. How could this have happened? And how could it have gone on for so long? In this hour, the voices you haven't heard, devout Catholics share their most intimate thoughts on the crisis in the Church. We'll hear the view from the pew. In Boston, the Roman Catholic Archdiocese has agreed to pay up to $30 million to settle 84 lawsuits against defrocked priest John Gagan, who was convicted of child molestation. And the story is far from over. The Boston Globe says this could be the costliest scandal in the history of the Catholic Church. WBUR's Monica Brady-Meyerhoff has been following the latest developments. Earlier, I asked her about the settlement reached this week in the Gagan case.
Well, the Boston Archdiocese agreed to settle 84 civil lawsuits against John Gagan. He's a former priest who is also convicted of child molestation. And church officials agreed to pay between $15 and $30 million to settle these claims. These are claims against Gagan and other church officials, including Cardinal Bernard Law, head of the Archdiocese. $15 million is the floor, $30 million is the ceiling. What's going to happen is an arbitrator will come in and meet with each alleged victim individually and assess, depending on the severity of what happened to them, how much money they should get from the church. And these alleged victims say everything happened from fondling to rape in some cases. Now, none of these, well, one of these actually has resulted in a criminal charge that Gagan was found guilty of, sexual assault and battery, and he's serving 9 to 10 years in jail for that crime. But all of these other claims have not gone to the criminal court because the statute of limitations has run out on them. So their only recourse is in the civil court in order to get some money from the church.
So with these payments, will the Catholic Church then be absolved of further civil, the threat of further civil suit in the John Gagan case?
Only for these 86 people involved. Actually, there are several more that could bring charges against the church because of actions of John Gagan. In fact, the attorney who settled the cases this week involving these victims of John Gagan says he's got 16 more people who allege to have been abused by John Gagan. He plans to bring more civil suits. So the church is looking at more lawsuits against Gagan, as well as many other priests in the Boston Archdiocese. Because over the past few weeks, the church has come out with more than 80 names of priests who are accused of sexually abusing minors. And they've given those names to law enforcement officials who are now investigating the claims and considering bringing criminal charges. Well, on the other side of that, there's the civil charges. So one can only expect that many of these accusations will result in civil claims, and the church could be fighting. Well, I shouldn't say fighting, because they say they always want to settle these claims and make it fair for the victims. So the church could be settling many more claims for priest sex abusers.
What might the scale of this be? I mean, presumably, the John Gagan case is an extreme case in the number of children abused by a single priest. But still, this is $30 million, and maybe still a tab is running for a single priest in the Boston Archdiocese nationally. What might the scale of this financial burden be, and how widespread are people thinking, fearing that the accusations may be?
Well, the scale is huge. John Gagan alone, as you said, $30 million that they agreed to this week, and the church has already paid $15 million to settle other lawsuits against John Gagan. And then there are many other priests who have claims against them. The Boston Globe has sat down and done a tally of it, and they've come up with a number of up to $100 million that just this archdiocese alone could be liable to pay in civil suits.
Is each archdiocese responsible to settle its own suits? Is the Vatican going to be chipping in to make this happen? Will there be help from Rome?
There will be no help from Rome. The way I understand the church finances is the diocese and the archdiocese give money to Rome. Rome never gives money back to them. The diocese alone are required to set up their own insurance funds, collect their own money, take care of their own finances entirely in a microcosm. So what can happen if a diocese doesn't have enough money to cover something, they can borrow from another diocese or borrow from a bank. But Rome isn't doling out any money here. And on a national scale, they're probably smart not to, because the tally on this nationally just could be huge. I spoke with a former psychotherapist who counseled abused priests, and he's been involved in more than 50 settlements that the church has done with priests around the nation. He said that if you add up all the secret and public settlements, and there have been many, many, many secret settlements that we have no idea about. And then you add to that the cost of therapy for victims and the cost of therapy for priests. He said one facility that treats priests who sexually abuse children has been full since 1988 at capacity at $350 a day for 52 priests since 1988. He just says, just start adding it up, throw in the legal fees, and he comes to the figure of $1 billion for the Catholic Church in America that all of these clergy abuse scandals could cost.
That's a very substantial figure. Could there, might there, or has there already come a point at which this impacts the actual operations week to week of the Catholic Church in America?
It's possible it could, because this archdiocese in Boston has said they aren't sure how they're going to pay this $30 million settlement against John Gagan and the church. The insurance funds won't cover it. And many other dioceses around the nation have said that insurance won't cover their costs or as well. And what they've had to do is sell property. One in Dallas neared bankruptcy, and the alleged victims in that case took a smaller settlement rather than bankrupting the diocese. Yeah.
Well, Monica, you've been covering this story, listening and talking with parish priests, with parishioners, with the archdiocese. Are you sensing real change coming in the church in the selection and lives of priests, in the power and involvement of the laity?
I'm sensing that everyone wants change, and there's definitely a grassroots effort starting to get underway that people want to bring about change. They want women in greater positions of power. They want the church to be less secretive. They want structural changes in the church. Some say that change has to begin with Cardinal Law stepping down. And in a meeting of Catholics this past weekend in Boston, many of them told that to him face-to-face, and he seemed to take it to heart that, he's always said he won't resign, but for the first time this past weekend, he said he's going to think a lot about what he's heard. And what he heard is there needs to be some major change down the pike. But the fact of the matter is, change such as structural change mm-hmm. comes from the Vatican. Mm-hmm. And unless there's a Vatican III Council, and there's not one plan that I know about, there won't be major changes to the church until the Vatican decides to get on board with this.
What might be the next developments in this story?
We're going to hear more and more sex abuse allegations against priests. I think once other claims start to get filed and investigations come to fruition, we're going to be hearing more specifics about that. So I don't think that's going to go away.
Monica, do you hear people talking? Has there ever been a greater crisis than this for the Catholic Church in America?
Definitely not. Not on the scale of the bad publicity it's generated, nor on the scale of victims affected, nor on the scale of money. I mean, it's, as we said, it could reach up to $1 billion. It's incredible. And I think a lot of older Catholics are just sitting back and saying, what happened to my church? What happened to the faith I had in my parish priest and the church as an institution to never do wrong by me? I think they're starting to question that.
Monica Brady Meyerhoff is a reporter for WBUR. Tonight on Point, we're opening our hearts and minds to lay Catholics as they share their personal reflections on the scandal in the Catholic Church. We're tuning in to how the spiritual lives and everyday lives of ordinary churchgoers have been changed. We'd like to hear from you. Are you going to Mass? Putting money in the collection plate? Wrestling with the horror? How are you talking about the crisis with your children and with God? Join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have a very full house tonight. Joining me in the studio are Joe Costello, Susan Jordan, and James Neville. They're active parishioners at St. Paul's Parish in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And we are honored and grateful to all of you for coming in tonight. Thanks very much for being here, Susan, Joe, and James.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Good evening. Welcome, Jack.
Hi, Tom.
We devoutly wish that we had you here in happier circumstances. But take us to the kitchen table of your homes. Take us to the vestibule of your church. Susan Jordan, how is this scandal hitting your world, your private conversations? Do you feel it's invaded your life as a committed Catholic?
It has invaded my life, and very much so, and it's sort of shocking. I was raised as a Catholic. I'm a cradle Catholic, as we like to call ourselves.
From birth,
and I have to say that my faith is not shaken, but my trust is certainly shattered. my confidence in the leadership of the diocese. I just am stunned to try to figure out how this could have happened and the sense of collusion that must have taken place. And I realize this is not a problem just within the diocese. There are other problems, similar problems throughout the country. Mm-hmm. So I think I really am sort of stepping back and saying, how did this happen? And how can we recover from this and move forward as a faith community? And I don't have any bright answers yet, but we're talking amongst ourselves.
But that's where you are. That's where you're looking out at the world from. Joe Costello, when did you first realize that these ripples of accusations against priests were becoming a tsunami?
It's hard to tie it to a particular date. Probably around the middle of January when we started to hear the details of the Gagin case. I know that was when I started to ask questions of people running the school that my sons go to, the priests in the church where we all go, and it's just continued to grow. Our sense of the dimensions of the problem has continued to grow. We react with disbelief that it could have happened, disbelief that it continues to grow in its dimensions, and with disbelief that it's been dealt with the way it has been up until this point and the way it continues to be dealt with.
There's so much to talk about tonight. But James Neville, how about you, your family, your fellow Catholics in your life? How has this crisis come into your life, your community, your conversations?
Sure. For me personally, it's made me for the first time really question my commitment to the Catholic Church. It hasn't affected my faith, faith in God or belief in Jesus' teachings. But I've never actually taken a step back and just asked myself the question, what does it mean to be Catholic, really? And do I really embrace all the teachings of the Catholic Church? So it sort of made me personally just reflect upon how committed I am to Catholicism.
Is it a conversation you feel comfortable, and I don't mean happy having, but comfortable having now with other Catholics? Is that level of questioning widespread, or do you find yourself at the boundary lines with that fundamental questioning, James Neville?
No, I think I do talk about it. I talk about it within my own family. I have a 10-year-old son who just became an altar boy this year. Mm-hmm. Not at St. Paul's. He's altar boy to another parish. Mm-hmm. As well as, talked about with immediate members of my family as well.
That must be an experience right now, a 10-year-old son becoming an altar boy. I mean, as Susan said, the issues of trust have become central here. How have you dealt with that in your life, your son becoming an altar boy in this environment?
Oh, it's made me think long and hard. Again, getting back to my commitment to being a Catholic and what kind of a potential risk I've
put. Go to the parish, talk to the priest, check out the scene?
Yes, I did.
In a way that you would not have a year ago?
Yes, I did. Now, and the good news, at least with regard to talking to the pastor, is I'm comfortable that he's not at risk. But what's terrible is to even have to
it
say that.
It must be awful to have that conversation. What did you say to the priest in that parish where your son is now an altar boy? How did you even bring it up?
I spoke to him after Mass that I wanted to get on his calendar and talk to him, and didn't want to talk to him then because I had my son with me.
Right.
But I just explained to him that, I actually had the conversation over the phone. Mm-hmm. That please don't take this as an affront to you or an attack on you, but I'm just calling as a concerned parent. And he lives down in New Jersey, so I just explained to the pastor there that, look,
and
I'm an active Catholic.
And was he offended, or did he understand?
Oh, no. I said, please understand the context of my call. I'm an active Catholic, and I live in Boston. And he chuckled, and he said, I understand that why you're calling. And, he explained what problems they've had in the diocese and specifically in the parish, how they were dealt with. We talked about the zero tolerance policy in his diocese. Mm-hmm. He also lives in New Jersey, which why that's relevant is by law, clergy are not exempt from disclosing instances of sexual abuse. Where,
So that brings up some of the structural issues, some of the surround of this whole thing. Right. But just imagine a Catholic father having to ask that of a Catholic priest. We're talking with lay Catholics. We're looking at the anguish of the Catholics right now as the child sex abuse scandal unfolds. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the anguish of the Catholics, the view from the pew as the scandal of the sexual abuse of children has unfolded within the Boston Archdiocese of the Catholic Church and well beyond. We're joined tonight by in the studio by Joe Costello, James Neville, and Susan Jordan. They're all parishioners at the St. Paul Parish in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and also by our news analyst, Jack Beattie. Jack, you can only imagine what this must be like around the kitchen table in Catholic homes, saying, "Oh my God, were we asleep at the switch? What do we have some responsibility here as well? And how do we live with this kind of scandal?"
It just seems to think that this is happening to the immigrant church. To think that the parishes, the very buildings that were built by our forefathers in the sweat of their brow, to think that these may have to be sold off to pay out for this. I mean, this is just, it's rending. The feeling, Ronald Reagan used to say, I didn't leave the Democratic Party, it left me. Well, in a way, you're not leaving the church, but to a significant degree, the hierarchy left you. They basically said, our concerns, protecting us, is more important than protecting your children. And it was feelings like that, that you being locked out of your spirituality, that led to the rebellion against the Catholic Church that broke the church during the Protestant Reformation. People couldn't get to God through this hierarchy because it was corrupt. I don't know. I don't mean to...
No, but there it is. Joe Costello, how bad is it?
It's very serious, and we don't know, and that's part of the seriousness. We don't know where it's all leading. We don't know what it's going to do to the church on which we all depend. I think one of the very encouraging things about it is that we see in the midst of all the discouragement is how quickly Catholics are to differentiate between their Catholicism and the Catholic Church. Even before the subject comes up, but certainly when every time it does come up, even before people are asked about it, you find Catholics asserting, my faith is intact. I'm concerned about what's going on in the archdiocese. I'm concerned about what's going on in the church, but my faith is intact. And so that which we've built the church around is still there. We are very concerned about the church that is around that faith and what all of this will do to it.
But what about that contest between that foundation of the Catholic Church that lies in the hearts and minds and faith of committed Catholics and the Catholic Church hierarchy, which is also in the Catholic Church, very important to the identity and expression of the church? Jim Neville, how are people resolving this in their minds? How do you both live with your personal faith and confront a hierarchy that I'm hearing around this table has in some dimension betrayed believers?
Well, I'm not sure how, I can't speak for everyone. I can talk about how that's actually part of the core of what I'm struggling with is that, part of a big part of the Catholic Church is the authoritarian kind of hierarchy of the priesthood and the whole structure all the way to the Vatican. And so it is part and parcel certainly with the Catholic Church. It isn't necessarily, to Joe's point, part and parcel with each of our individual faith in God and faith in Jesus' teaching. But that's one of the things that I struggle with most is how to separate the two in my mind is if I'm uncomfortable with the authoritarian nature of the church and also the norms and behavior that has just grown up over centuries. You know, it's a 2,000-year-old institution. That has led to the whole way the pedophile problems were dealt with or not dealt with, depending on how you look at it.
Susan Jordan, you talked earlier about your fear of that there has been actually collusion in the church hierarchy to cover up, at least, I guess, this problem. Is that really what you mean to say? Do you see a kind of collusion, a conspiracy of the very people who are supposed to exercise the church's function?
Tom, I don't see how this could have gone on without knowledge, widespread knowledge within the church hierarchy. And it's impossible to sort of understand how that went on. My understanding is that these cases were being dealt with over time with settlements, and there was a lot of secrecy in order to avoid scandal, which I think is rather ironic because here we have a larger scandal than would have happened otherwise. On the flip side of that, what I would say is one of my big concerns is protection of the what I call the other innocents. I hope this will not become a witch hunt in which innocent priests will be accused. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how that's going to work out as things move forward. Mm-hmm. But the majority of the priests are wonderful, and we rely on them. And I don't want to see the priesthood itself destroyed over this. So I think there's a balancing act and judgment and wisdom that has to take place, and we desperately need that.
So there's that respect for the priests who are not part of this and desire to protect and hold them, but at the same time, this really must be terribly wounding sense of collusion that you say must have gone on. But let me ask you this, as committed practicing Catholics, as you see what has just exploded here and you look at it, Do you look at yourself some? Do you say, did you have any premonition yourselves? Did you have any sense that somehow this was in the eaves? You know, the human mind is a very sensitive instrument. Do you look back now and say, my God, I felt some ripple in the air, and I was just always unwilling or afraid to name it? Or was it a complete and absolute shock?
It was the sort of thing that non-Catholic friends of mine would bring up, or Catholics, what we like to call lapsed Catholics,
okay,
which means they're, you
know,
of touch for a while or permanently. They would often bring it up, and I would think, it's just another Catholic bashing thing. And quite honestly, I didn't give it much credence. Mm-hmm. So this did kind of sneak up on me as sort of, oh, gosh, they must have been right all along. And I hated admitting that. That pained me a lot. Mm-hmm.
Joe, Jim?
I think it's... I think it's an issue that's been lurking around in the church for some time, and one could not be an active Catholic without having a nagging concern at some level about pedophilia, about priest abuse of teenagers. But it hasn't been an overwhelming subject for us. There was a book written by Charles Morris about 5 years ago called American Catholic, in which he talked about that. He mentioned that as one of the things that came up in the book, and he spoke about it as a condition which had peaked and was waning. Mm-hmm. And I think most of us who had ever thought about it in that context as something that was not on our minds currently. It came up again in 1992, I think it was, with the Porter case. And there was so much done in the church locally about it at that time. I think we thought that the condition was behind us, and we're stunned at the scope of the Gagin case.
I want to allow our callers in here. We're talking tonight with lay Catholics about the anguish of church members looking out at what's happened, at the scandal that's before us all now. Lay Catholics, what has this crisis meant to you in your life, in your faith? And non-Catholics, what do you want to ask your fellow citizens, the Catholics in the pews? Catholics, how are you explaining this to yourself, to your children? Is the church coming to grips with this crisis? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Anne is on the line. Welcome, Anne. You're on the air.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Sure.
I have four kids. I am a cradle Catholic also, and we go to church every Sunday and don't eat meat on Fridays and so on. But I think one part that's missing from this discussion, and I'm sure that Jim and Susan and Joe probably feel this too, is that I think we're very complicit as lay Catholics in this whole thing.
How so, Anne? How so?
Well, because we check our self-respect at the door when we enter a church. When we talk to a priest, it's not like talking to an equal. We pay him unreal deference that helps create his power over helpless individuals, helps us create his delusion that he has the right to not question himself.
But Anne, isn't that part and parcel of the church tradition?
It might be part of the tradition, but we have helped create it. And the great thing is we can now help change it. But we have to take moral responsibility for a church where men got so powerful that their self-indulgence reached mm-hmm. such an evil level. Mm-hmm. And none of us questioned those guys. I mean, the things that send chills up my spine mm. are the people who saw the priest taking little boys into the bedroom and didn't do anything. And to a lesser extent, every single one of us church-going Catholics are bystanders. And so now there's a big question. What are we going to do? Right now, the Archdiocese is refusing to turn over the Shanley file to the Ford family. Are we just going to wait and hope this gets solved, or are we going to flood them with phone calls? I mean, we really, this is our revolution for the victims. And if we just keep showing up and doing nothing, then we have to share part of the moral culpability for what happens to those victims now.
And please stand by. I want to put your thoughts to Jim Neville.
Yeah, and hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
I would disagree with you that we created the situation. I think we reinforced rather than created the situation you described. But I would agree with you, Ann, that you know, to use a cliche, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. I think now that we know the extent of the abuse and also the dysfunction in terms of addressing it, you know, now it's sort of each of us has to decide, do we want to just close our eyes and ears, or do we want to try to do something about it?
Ann, is that strong enough for you?
I mean, I absolutely accept that, but I actually think we recreate it every time we say hello, Father, and listen to a mediocre sermon, or worse, an offensive sermon, and say nothing. I think we recreate it every Sunday, Jim, but I'm happy to go with what you say as long as it gets people active finally.
Ann, thanks so much for your candor and for your call. Joe Costello, let's talk about where this needs to go. Ann is saying, she wants a revolution for the victims. Is there a path?
And I have to say that the three of us here in this room share your outrage. And we agree that something needs to be done about it, starting with the laity. This church changed, the definition of the church changed fundamentally with the Vatican II Council in the mid-1960s. And I think we are called upon at this time, in this crisis, to act on the changes that took place in the church at that time. The fundamental change that I view, the most fundamental change, as I view what Vatican II did, was, as several people have described it, it turned the pyramid on its head. It put the people of God, the population of the church, in a most important position, and the hierarchy in a position to serve them. Now, granted, they didn't give us the keys to the kingdom, but the responsibility is clearly ours. It has been since that time. I completely agree with you that if we haven't taken up that authority that comes along with the responsibility that was given to us by Vatican II, we are to some extent complicit.
But Anne says Catholics pay unreal deference, in her words, to priests. Susan says there's collusion in the priesthood. How are you going to use that power of the Vatican II? Does it need to be made real in some way that hasn't been to date?
First, we are an organization in transition. We grew up in a church that was deferential to priests. We learned to respect them, and the vast majority of them have deserved that respect. In the situation in which we find ourselves now, we need to be careful that we continue to respect, to care about, to appreciate, and to support that vast majority of priests that are not part of the scandal. But we need to take our own responsibility. In our parish, for example, the three people in this room and quite a large number of others have assembled into an ad hoc group that is working among its own members and in conjunction with the established organizations within the parish to figure out what we can do to take responsibility for this problem and begin to solve it.
Mike is on the line. Welcome, Mike. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking me.
Sure, Mike.
You asked the question about what people feel. My experience was in 1948. I'm in my 60s now.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was your experience, Mike?
I was sodomized by a priest. I was an altar boy. And, I put it out of my mind until all this came up again.
It's a long time, Mike.
Now the anger starts to come out. The result of that was I would never even date a Catholic girl. I married a good Protestant woman, raised my children. They never saw the inside of a church. And today I think to myself, maybe I should be grateful because a couple of hundred years ago, they could have made a castrati out of me. You know, let's not forget that.
So, Mike, when you see now that the Catholic Church is reaching 40 and 50 years back into its records and putting those records out in public, it sounds like you would say that's the right thing to do. That's the necessary thing to do. Your case goes back a long way.
It certainly is the right thing to do. I mean, you have to, it's unimaginable the terror that you feel as a child like that. And like I said to somebody the other day, I could still feel his hot breath on my neck.
Mike, when you hear the Catholics in the studio with us tonight, you as someone who left the church after that experience, what would you ask of them? What do you want of the Catholics who are still inside the church?
Hey, I'm not a part of it anymore. You people go do what you want to do. I say you people because I'm not even a part of you anymore. Even though my mother and father came from Ireland and they were devout Catholics. If my mother's probably turning over in a grave now listening to me say this, but I don't want anything to do with any of those people.
Mike, thanks for your honesty and your call. Susan Jordan, when you hear this, and we all know now that Mike is far from alone, what emotion, what thoughts does it pull up in you?
Well, I my heart goes out to him. I think this is shattering. It's I still find it just unconscionable to think that the priests, the shepherds that we rely on for spiritual guidance would allow this to happen. It's just I really can't figure it. I hope that Mike and others will have support and comfort that they probably haven't had for many years. And I know there are initiatives in place to do that. It's far later than it should be, but I know that that is beginning to happen. So that part is encouraging. But nothing will ever. Will ever heal that hurt.
It's not going to make it right for Mike. Jim Neville, what does the church have to do to show the other Mikes out there that they care with the seriousness that this requires?
Well, I'm sure I don't have a complete answer, but things that come to mind are, one is addressing the whole question of why was it so rampant in the first place? I mean, there's been the officious one thing that just infuriates me is the officious response that comes out of the archdiocese and various spokespeople, and nowhere is the fundamental question asked: why is it so prevalent? Occasionally, you hear, "Well, it's no more prevalent in the among priests than it is in the general population." Well, two things: one is I certainly hope that's not the case because that means we have a whole lot of pederasts, which are active pedophiles, among us. And then, secondly, that's not the issue; it shouldn't be the standard. So I think that's part of it. Is coming to grips with it. It's a heinous crime, and the reason why I say that is that's part of the context. It's not just an indiscretion or a bad judgment or a character flaw. It's a heinous crime to take advantage of children, and then to for it to be a person of the cloth, if you will, and a person in power. It's even worse. So I think that question has to be addressed, and I think a true apology, a heartfelt apology, not an officious kind of sounding apology, would help the Mikes of the world.
We're talking tonight with lay Catholics about the anguish of the Catholics, the scandal over sexual abuse of children in the Catholic Church. Lay Catholics, what has this crisis meant to you in your life, in your faith? And non-Catholics, what do you want to ask your fellow citizens, the Catholics in the pews? What does this crisis mean for America's Catholic Church? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the anguish of the Catholics, the view from the pew with lay Catholics Joe Costello, Jim Neville, and Susan Jordan. You're welcome to join us as well. Catholics, how are you explaining the scandal in the Catholic Church to yourself, to your children? Is the Church coming to grips with this crisis? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beattie, just before the break, Jim Neville was asking, why was this so rampant? Perhaps, why is this so rampant? And asking, how prevalent is it?
Well, you know, the Boston Globe has a fascinating piece today that sort of compares apples to apples, this church and its clergy to other churches in New England. They find that the United Church of Christ, only three clergy accused over the last 50 years. These were defrocked and jailed. The Episcopal Diocese, only three cases in memory. Two of the accused priests were jailed. Unitarian, one case over the last 50 years, defrocked, jailed. Lutheran, one case. The American Baptist Church, one case. The man was sent to prison. Greek Orthodox Church, one case, sent to prison. The only church where they find anything like this is in the Hare Krishnas. But even the Hare Krishnas wrote a detailed expose of their own wrongdoing. What is this telling us? That these other clergies who have similar access to children, we have to assume that this didn't happen in these other denominations.
Joe Costello?
I think the thing that we need to recognize is not only the outrage that's been perpetrated against the children, but the fact that there are conditions in the organization that could allow such a thing to exist.
How do you analyze those? What are they?
In secular organizations, there is a well-developed methodology of organizational development for analyzing what the processes and the procedures and the mannerisms of an organization are.
And in the Catholic Church?
And I don't know what the result would be if that methodology was applied to the church. I think that's what we need to do. We need, first of all, to make sure that the pedophilia doesn't continue. But we need to look for the organizational flaws that allow such an outrageous condition to come to exist and to be so pervasive over such a long period of time.
Joe, I hear you, but it sounds a little bit like a B-school analysis of this thing. Susan Jordan, intuitively, you must have a sense of an answer to Jim's question. Somehow, why has it been so rampant?
Again, I mentioned the collusion before.
But why collusion? Right? Why would there be collusion over something that priests are certainly not taught to collude around things like this, or are they somehow?
No, I don't think they're taught to collude, but I do think it's been a tradition in the church to sort of treat these things discreetly, if you will, and do the settlements. And I think
there's something more than just scandal aversion here. I guess the obvious things that come up. What about the celibate life? What about the hierarchy and the secrecy?
And what about the fact, Jim, that it's
all male? Do somehow these things factor in your minds?
I think it's the screening in the seminaries has to be looked at very carefully, and that's being talked about. We don't. I think that it's very likely, or at least possible, that the quality of the people coming into the seminary. Keep in mind, there's a shortage of priests, so they're desperate for priests. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that's definitely happening, but that's something that needs to be looked at. So that's, you know, that if the bar has been lowered, then we have to really look at that carefully.
And Jim, Joe, what about this central issue of celibacy? We know that there's a rich literature in the Catholic Church about the importance, the centrality of celibacy to the priesthood. Are you, in your personal views, reconsidering this?
I personally don't think that's the issue. There was an excellent, referring to the Globe again, there was an excellent editorial on the issue of celibacy written by Kevin Poit, a Jesuit from BC High, that I think was an excellent explanation of that. I think, to go back to the earlier issue about the organization, I think the urgency that the Church feels and has felt over its entire history to protect the message of Christ and to make sure that that message is passed on intact from generation to generation has created a sense of rightness in the people who control that message and an absence of accountability to the people to whom that message is delivered.
Has it led to a kind of corruption?
I think it has led over a period of time to an organization which does not hold itself responsible in the way that other organizations do to the constituencies to which it is responsible.
Jim Neville?
I don't think celibacy necessarily causes one to be a pedophile or a pederast. I'm not a psychologist.
We're not making the connection, but I just ask, how are you thinking and talking about it?
But I think my own theory is that the secrecy and the norms in the culture to protect may have actually encouraged the recruitment of predators. Because if you're a predator, wouldn't you want to go somewhere where you're going to be protected and not addressed? That is a theory. Maybe there's a route there.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Elizabeth is joining us on the line. Welcome, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm a teacher at a Jesuit middle school for boys in Boston. Mm-hmm. And in response to my friend being accused last week, I wrote a letter, and I'd like to share it with you, piece of it.
You had colleagues at the school who were accused of pedophilia, pederasty?
In a school close to ours at BC High.
Okay.
So.
Share us a portion, Elizabeth. Our time is short.
I will. A friend of mine, a priest, confided in me that he is uneasy about wearing his collar in public. He's scared that the symbol once invited polite nods and courtesy, the best in us, but now it invites the worst in us. He's a target for insults and fear. He doesn't want to scare anybody or endanger himself. He slips his collar into his pocket as he steps out onto the street, anticipating and avoiding confrontation. And then I try to answer the question, well, then who can we trust? Well, we only have each other to trust. We have to believe that the other isn't out to get us, and we have to teach our children and students to be honest with us, to let us help them. They have to believe that someone can help them, no matter how confused or scared they are. And we have to earn that trust. We know the terrible things happen to innocent victims, but we still have faith and goodness in people.
Mm. Elizabeth, thanks for sharing that. I want to get one more call in before the end of the hour. Steve is on the line. Welcome, Steve. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Since this crisis started, I've been reading every day in the paper, and every day I think to myself, there but for the lack of the grace of God go I.
What do you mean, Steve?
Well, I'm an atheist, and this seems to me to be the classic manifestation of the philosopher's problem of evil.
That is?
Why would God allow this to happen to his children? I mean, would parents here on earth allow this to happen to their children?
Well, that goes right to the heart of it in a faith sense, Stephen. Thanks for that. Joe Costello, what about it? At the heart of your faith, how do you wrestle with this? I mean, there is an evil here. How do you put that together with a loving God?
There is an evil for which the people who have committed it are responsible. I feel terrible for the victims of it. But my faith is intact, and my determination as a lay Catholic to be involved in a solution to this terrible problem is very strong, and I really hope that other lay Catholics take on that same responsibility as we're seeing around St. Paul's.
Mm. Susan Jordan, last thoughts. Cardinal Law, his future.
I don't see how the Church in this diocese will get beyond this crisis with the cardinal remaining in the position that he's in. And I say that with great angst. Joe and I actually attended the convocation last Saturday and sat in the second row.
A couple thousand Catholics meeting in Boston.
Several thousand. And we had a good opportunity to observe Cardinal Law. He's obviously in anguish over this. And I say that with great, you know, great sorrow. But I don't see closure on this. I don't see moving forward. I know he's staying on to try to be part of the solution, having been part of the problem, but I think a change in leadership is almost inevitable.
This time is really too short, but we can't thank all of you for sharing with us tonight, to give us a glimpse and to share the emotions and the world of thought and anguish that's going on in your community right now. Joe Costello, James Neville, Susan Jordan from St. Paul's Parish in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you to each and every one of you for coming in tonight.
You're welcome.
Thank you,
Tom,
for having us.
Jack Beattie, last thoughts.
Gosh, St. Paul's Parish, I think of St. Paul on faith, the evidence of things unseen. Mm-hmm. We have to look past, I guess, the visible to something beyond. But what a trial of faith this is. But I hear a reforming energy. Take back our church. And that's a dormant Catholic like me. Boy, I haven't heard that kind of thing since Vatican II.
Jack, thanks very much for being with us hour. Growing up in the Soviet Union, Isabella Taborowski dreamed about American freedoms. She came to the United States right after the fall of the Berlin Wall. She's now a journalist. She volunteers here at On Point. America has become her home. But in this diary, she says she can't help drawing on her experiences growing up in the Soviet Union when processing her American reality post-September 11th.
Sometimes I think I overreact. I remember my first personal encounter with political correctness. I was sitting with my friends around a table in a crowded graduate school cafeteria. The conversation turned to race, and suddenly a transformation came over the table. Voices went quieter, heads got pulled into shoulders. Somebody threw a furtive glance around him. We all had to draw in closer to hear the speaker. Nobody else seemed to notice, but I couldn't get rid of a childhood image. My aunts and uncles in my grandmother's kitchen in Barnaul, a grimy industrial city in West Siberia, pulling in their heads and lowering their voices down to whisper for fear of being overheard by those walls that were supposed to have ears. I was stunned. One of the reasons we had come to America was to free ourselves from that pervasive fear, the fear of saying what you think, of being condemned in a sweeping accusation on the basis of a single dissenting opinion. That fear, it was such a part of us. It got into our blood, turned us into slaves. America had given me one of the most liberating experiences of my life, the ability to question openly what I was told. So why was I having this ghastly déjà vu in a university setting, of all places? The post-September 11th events have provided a particularly fertile ground for such comparisons. For me, each new sign of the administration's secretiveness conjures up dark images from the history of the country I grew up in. The idea of an office of strategic influence sounded far more sinister to me than to most of my American friends. To them, it was just an absurdity. To me, it was an Orwellian proposition, more frightening for the fact that I knew from personal experience what it was like to live in a society fed with lies, where Big Brother wanted to control not just my words, but my very thoughts. I know how easily language can be molded into clichés, how endless repetition washes away the meaning of words, making them impervious to questioning. When I'm told repeatedly that George W. revealed himself as a statesman extraordinaire in the wake of September 11th, I can't shake off the sour taste of the memory of the Soviet newspapers, the newspapers where the same opinions would be repeated so many times, nobody bothered to think anymore what they really meant. When I read dispatches from Afghanistan, I want to reach for my old skills of reading between the lines. Are we really winning this major battle? What was the real cause of those helicopter crashes? Why do I get the feeling that just like during the Soviet-Afghan war, I'm still getting only part of the story? We in this country believe that we have freedom of the press. Then how come a recent study of the post-9/11 coverage by the Project for Excellence in Journalism found that barely 10% of the stories examined could be perceived as dissenting from the administration's point of view? And then there is this whole patriotism thing. I feel a pang of recognition when I hear of a politician suggesting that his rival is unpatriotic just because he dared raise a difficult question. And so I want to ask, what is the true meaning of patriotism? Is it in the ubiquitous displays of flags? Is it in the absence of dissenting opinions? We had all of that in the Soviet Union, you see, and look where it got that country. Periodically, I have to shake myself up. I tell myself that I'm exaggerating. One country's history does not freely translate into that of another. I have lived in America long enough to know that, in fact, Americans have an extraordinary ability to reconcile two seemingly contradictory traits, the deeply seated faith in their governments and just as deeply seated a suspicion of it. That when push comes to shove, Americans will tell the government to back off and will demand to know the whole truth. And yet I worry. I worry that perhaps the idea of freedom of speech has become too much of a given in this country. I worry that in taking it for granted, we're losing the habit of questioning what our government tells us, that in preferring to hear only one version of a story, we're losing the ability to see the perspective of another country, another culture, and thus the opportunity to see ourselves from a different angle. To me, freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of the press are some of the most fundamental freedoms there are. That's what America was all about to us when we were dreaming about it from the other end of the world. That's what Soviet citizens demanded as one of Perestroika's very first reforms. Americans have these freedoms as their birthright. Might they not unwittingly let them slip away? To me, one of the most profound expressions of patriotism lies in criticizing the country one loves, because one knows that that criticism will only make it better. So here's to the freedom to question. Here's to the freedom of dissent.
Isabella Tabarovsky lives in Boston. Listeners, we want to hear your story on our program. Radio Diaries start with an email or a letter from you. They begin as essays about 750 words long, giving your personal perspective on the news. How is the conflict in the Middle East, the war on terror, the on-again, off-again recession, or the crisis in the Catholic Church affecting your life? Share your story with us. Send your email to onpoint@wbur.org or drop us a line at WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to On Point.